Thanks so much, and thank you all for joining us this evening. I'd like to start just by introducing our expert panel here today, Dr. Kevin Kalinske from the Winship Cancer Institute, where he is a professor of medicine and chair of the Department of Hematology Oncology, Dr. Komal Jhaveri, who is the chair for junior faculty at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and then Dr. William Gradisher, who is the professor of breast cancer and professor of medicine at the Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center at Northwestern, just up the street from me, so we are good friends. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Kalinske, who will be talking about mechanisms of endocrine resistance, novel therapeutic mechanisms to overcome resistance, and integrating biomarker testing strategies in hormone receptor positive HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer.
All right, thank you, Dr. Nanda. Hi, everybody. Thank you guys for attending tonight's session. Should be an interesting conversation. All right, let's talk hormone receptor positive advanced disease. So this is an illustration just of, you know, the advances that we've made in the last several years. But in particular, I just want to highlight even what's been going on within the last few years, right? Where we have approvals for patients with endocrine-sensitive disease like elacestrant and capivasertib, and then we have a novel 120 with a novelisib for those patients who are early relapsers. And then we also have additional agents for patients with endocrine-resistant disease, like some of which were just approved or had a change in indication even within the last few months. So this is a slide that I suspect a number in the audience are familiar with in terms of the data, but ultimately for our patients with newly metastatic disease, CDK4/6 inhibitors have really changed the landscape of how we treat our patients, and also, of course, we have approval of ribociclib and abemaciclib in the early stage setting as well. We see a consistent progression-free survival with a pretty similar magnitude of benefit across the way, and we have seen with some studies an improvement in progression-free survival. We see a progression-free survival in all studies and overall survival for some studies. And so these are data which have just demonstrated, and there have been others as well, looking at this post-CDK4/6 inhibitor space, where we are seeing an increase in specific alterations, RB1, loss of function mutations, but also ESR1 mutations as well, which is really what we're going to be focusing on for a good amount of this particular talk. So there are various strategies one may think about in order to overcome resistance for hormone receptor positive disease, whether we're blocking estrogen synthesis or modulating the degrading the receptor, or also thinking about other targeted therapies that may block downstream signaling pathways, i.e., for instance, the PI3K/AKT/mTOR pathway. ESR1 mutations, how I describe this to patients is commonly, the way that your urinary tract infection is resistant to whatever antibiotic that we're giving is the way that as you're taking an aromatase inhibitor and this is no longer responding, it may be due to, for instance, an ESR1 mutation. So ESR1 mutations allow for ligand-independent activation, and then a pro-metastatic transcriptional program. You can see the frequency of the ESR1 mutations that we see, you know, which is around 40%, and we'll talk through some of these data of when we see ESR1 mutations, the metastatic setting in pretreated patients. One can also see in this table the different ESR1 mutations and their frequencies that can be identified. Including, you know, for instance, D538G, which we see in about a third of those. You know, the other thing that I just want to highlight is that not all ESR1 mutations are the same, that there are some that we think of as being more sensitive to something like fulvestrant, but in particular Y537S, which there are some preclinical data to suggest that these may be less sensitive to fulvestrant. And so this table highlights the prevalence of having ESR1 mutations You know, when you have a patient at the initiation of a first-line endocrine therapy, that rate of having ESR1 mutations is about 5%, as opposed to, you know, second-line plus, where that can be anywhere from about a third to about 40% of patients. So, you know, when we're checking for ESR1 mutations, you have a patient who has second-line treatment, for instance, after progression on AI plus CDK4/6 inhibition, it's important to think about the tissue that you are looking at, whether that's circulating tumor DNA or a metastatic biopsy at that time. But if you're utilizing tissue before somebody had a tumor that progressed on aromatase inhibitor, you're not going to see these mutations as they are adaptive resistance, a sign of adaptive resistance. ER positive metastatic disease, as I just mentioned, can be marked by several acquired genomic alterations. Just spent some time talking about ESR1 mutations. And these are the different studies that we have. And then also the rate of mutations. And so this is just going to the point that I was highlighting, that if you're testing this a little bit earlier, that you may see, meaning, you know, a newly metastatic disease, that rate of having ESR1 mutations is lower compared to what we see in other clinical trials, which was post aromatase inhibitor in the frontline setting. So these are data now that, you know, were published back in 2020 that was looking at the SOPHIA in effect trials, which was essentially looking at fulvestrant versus XMS stain and the presence or absence of ESR1 mutations. And the take home from these curves are really that the patients who have ESR1 mutations were not responding to aromatase inhibitors, but may respond in a better way to fulvestrant. I've already discussed these data and highlighted Mona Lisa 2, which was the frontline study that I was discussing in terms of the lower rate of ESR1 mutations compared to other clinical trials that we have in a more heavily pretreated population. These curves are just demonstrating one of the points that I was making, just in terms of the in vivo activity of fulvestrant, that not all ESR1 mutations are the same. And again, just to highlight the point, Y537S mutations, which is seen, for instance, here in purple, doesn't have the same sort of impact, or fulvestrant doesn't have the same sort of level of activity as what we can see with some of the other ESR1 mutations. And it can require higher inhibition in order to achieve a clinical effect. So that's a long way of saying there are a number of novel endocrine therapies that are in development, new SERMs, new SERDs, PROTAX, complete estrogen receptor antagonists, and then also SARCAs. And I think that this is where we will move forward to the video. I don't know if we'll pull this up, that will explain the mechanism of action.
Estrogen exerts its effect by binding to estrogen receptors in the cytoplasm, causing them to dimerize and translocate into the nucleus. These estrogen receptor complexes bind to specific sequences in the promoters of target genes involved in cell growth and survival, which leads to activation of transcription. Aromatase CYP19A1 is an enzyme that catalyzes a key step in the synthesis of estrogen from androgens. While estrogen is produced primarily in the ovaries in premenopausal women, in postmenopausal women, estrogen is mainly produced in peripheral tissues of the body through this process of aromatization. Aromatase inhibitors act by inhibiting the action of aromatase, preventing the production of estrogen, and thereby reducing circulating levels of estrogen in postmenopausal women. Like estrogen, selective estrogen receptor modulators, or SERMs, like tamoxifen, compete with estrogen for binding to estrogen receptors in the cytoplasm. This leads to dimerization of the estrogen receptors, transport into the nucleus, and binding to DNA just as if they were bound to estrogen. However, SERMs can act as either agonists or antagonists, drawing in either transcriptional repressors or activators in a tissue-specific manner. In breast tissue, SERMs act as an estrogen receptor antagonist, while in bone tissue, it acts as an agonist and supports the maintenance of bone mineral density in postmenopausal women. Selective estrogen receptor degraders, or SERDs, such as fulvestrant and elacestrant, are considered pure estrogen receptor antagonists. These agents help to destabilize the estrogen receptor, causing impaired mobility and disrupting translocation to the nucleus, leading to degradation and downregulation of the receptor protein. SERDs have been shown to induce the destabilization and degradation of both wild-type receptors and those harboring an ESR1 mutation. Protealysis targeting chimeras or PROTACs are a new class of therapeutic agents that harness the ubiquitin proteasome system to degrade a target protein. A PROTAC is a three-part molecule that is composed of a moiety that binds the protein of interest, a linker, and an E3 ubiquitin ligase binding moiety. Inside the cell, the PROTAC simultaneously binds the target protein, in this case the estrogen receptor and an E3 ligase. Formation of this ternary complex facilitates ubiquitination of the target protein. The ubiquitin protease system involves a cascade of three enzymes: ubiquitin activating enzymes, E1, ubiquitin conjugating enzymes, E2, and substrate-specific ligases, E3. ER-targeted PROTACs simultaneously recruit E3 ligase and the estrogen receptor, bringing these proteins into spatial proximity while simulating specific recognition of the estrogen receptor by E3 ligase. Once the estrogen receptor has been polyubiquitinated, it is targeted for degradation by the 26S proteasome. ER-targeted PROTACs have also been shown to work against both wild-type and ESR1 mutated estrogen receptors.
All right, so just to move along, and then I'll pass this along to my esteemed colleagues. SERDs, there are a number of SERDs in development. We have the approval of elacestrant. We've seen data from Dr. Zaveri with imlunestrant, which is an oral SERD that is not yet approved based upon the EMBER-3 data. And there are a number of studies in both the metastatic and early stage setting that are ongoing. I do want to highlight, because this is something that actually came up in one of the sessions earlier today. One of the questions was, well, what about ESR1 mutations? And if you have a patient who doesn't have progression of their tumor, like, would you ever switch to a SERD early? And so we have data from Francois Bedard, the PADA-1 study, which was an investigator-initiated trial, which looked at patients who were getting an aromatase inhibitor. They have, you know, endocrine-sensitive disease. They were getting an aromatase inhibitor and a CDK4/6 inhibitor, in which case this was palbociclib. And then they were getting ESR1 mutation detection being performed. And then if ESR1 mutations were seen and they hadn't had radiographic progression, then they were randomized to continue what they were receiving versus switching to fulvestrant plus palbociclib. And what we saw was there was this improvement in progression-free survival. And they also reported PFS2, which essentially means from the time that they were originally randomized, they went on to that therapy, they had progression, then they went on to the next bit of therapy, and it's looking from the time of that progression to when they were initially randomized, and there was this improvement in PFS2 as well. So this was thought to be, you know, a very interesting study, didn't really change practice as of yet, but we are awaiting data. We've seen by press release SERENA-6, which is a phase 3 trial that we have seen is a quote-unquote positive study, but we'll see this at an upcoming symposium, which was looking at the same sort of approach, but instead of fulvestrant, chemizestrant, and it opened up to other CDK4/6 inhibitors as well, and we'll see what the PFS and PFS2 and other endpoints look like in this. So I do want to highlight the guidelines that we have, including NCCN guidelines, which does not recommend testing with primary archived tissue, given the acquired nature of ESR1 mutations, which I had referenced earlier, and then the ASCO guidelines, where they essentially mentioned that blood-based ctDNA is preferred, that one should utilize a certified assay, and that it may warrant, if you, for instance, check ctDNA after a CDK4/6 inhibitor, you don't have an ESR1 mutation, you may want to check it again in the future. This is the rapid recommendation for utilization of ESR1 mutations that just further describe what I had just mentioned. And then I want to lastly, before passing this off, talk about other mechanisms of endocrine resistance. You can see those listed here, including HER2 alterations. PI3K AKT pathway alterations as well, which is, of course, a way in which we can target with agents that we have approved now. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about these agents because it's its own separate topic, but we do have alpelisib, we have capivasertib, which is not just for those with PIK3CA mutations, but also P10 or AKT1E17K mutations. We also have inavolisib specifically for those patients with PIK3CA mutations that recur on or within 12 months of their adjuvant endocrine therapy. And so to summarize before we move along, for patients who have hormone receptor positive HER2 negative disease, this is our current landscape. Let's say you have a patient who is on a CDK4/6 inhibitor and endocrine therapy at the time of progression. Once you think about looking for with next generation sequencing, you have options if patients have a PI3K or AKT P10 alteration, fulvestrant plus capivasertib. One also has the option of elacestrant if you have a patient who is on their prior CDK, in particular for patients who are on their prior CDK4/6 inhibitor for at least a year without progression. That's right now given as a single agent. You also have fulvestrant plus everolimus as a potential option, or exemestane plus everolimus, which I would consider in patients without an ESR1 mutation, or even potentially switching endocrine therapy and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And then we'll see ultimately if imlunestrant gets approval in the upcoming future. And the other question just being, and perhaps we'll talk about this later or not, is just the data that we saw with EMBER-3 demonstrated that with imlunestrant, the benefit compared to standard of care endocrine therapy was really in those, exclusively in those with ESR1 mutations, though the combination of imlunestrant plus abemaciclib was better than imlunestrant regardless of the presence or absence of mutations. So that may be an upcoming change in the future. And then, of course, at the time of endocrine resistance, you can see we move on to ADCs, CDK, or cytotoxic chemotherapy. But we'll be really focusing on endocrine-sensitive disease. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kevin, for setting the stage. So, certainly a lot happening in ER-positive space, a lot of mechanisms of resistance. The one that we're focusing for tonight are novel endocrine therapies. And I'll start with oral SERDs, where we've seen one that has already made it to the finish line. We've already had approval for one of these oral SERDs, elacestrant, and a few others that I'll talk about where we have some data from phase 3 trials as well. So these are the NCCN guidelines for hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative, metastatic breast cancer. This is the most recent guideline update that we've seen. And really, we've walked through all the data in terms of what Kevin showed us in terms of what kind of therapies do we utilize in what line. Specifically, today we'll focus on the oral SERD, which has made it here, which is specifically for ESR1 mutant tumors, and that's elacestrant. And that's for patients who've had progression already on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. So that approval was based on the phase 3 EMERALD study. These were ER-positive patients who were allowed to have no more than 2 lines of endocrine therapy in the metastatic setting, no more than 1 line of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting, and were then randomized 1:1 to receiving oral elacestrant at 400 milligrams daily versus investigator choice of endocrine therapy for a primary endpoint of progression-free survival in all patients and also focusing of progression-free survival in ESR1 mutants. With respect to the prior therapies and the baseline demographics that are summarized on the table here on the right, I'd like to draw your attention that about 54% had received 1 line of prior endocrine therapy. All patients had received prior CDK4/6 inhibitor therapy. A third of these patients had also received prior fulvestrant-based therapy, and 20% had prior chemotherapy in the metastatic setting prior to enrollment on this trial. And here are the results for the Kaplan-Meier curves for all patients on your left and for patients with ESR1 mutations on the right. And as you can see, elacestrant demonstrated an improvement in progression-free survival versus standard of care endocrine therapy in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer, including all patients. Here, the hazard ratio was 0.70. On your right, you see that the benefit is deeper and better, or the curves are separated wider in the ESR1 mutant tumors, and That's also reflected in the hazard ratio, where it's 0.56. So while there was benefit seen in all patients, I think it was more seen in the ESR1 mutant tumors. The proportion of patients that are progression-free in the ESR1 mutant cohort was higher, and so was reflected also in the median PFS differences when we had seen between endocrine therapy in all patients compared to elacestrant versus those in elacestrant tumors, in ESR1 mutant tumors, I apologize. And so when you look at the same comparison for all patients and patients whose tumors harbor ESR1 mutants, while comparing elacestrant specifically to fulvestrant, so physician choice endocrine therapy allowed fulvestrant or exemestane or other endocrine therapy, but here we're looking at purely with fulvestrant and oral SERD with the other SERD. Again, similar to what we saw in the overall patient population, we see benefit in all patients, a deeper and a better benefit in those tumors that harbor ESR1 mutations. Hazard ratio specifically in that setting is 0.5. With respect to overall survival, these data are still immature. We require more maturity and more longer follow-up to be able to better understand whether there might be a potential for OS benefit. The primary endpoint, as we said, is progression-free survival. So as such, the current label, the FDA approval, is for patients whose tumors harbor ESR1 mutations, given that the benefit that was driven from that is what drove the overall hazard ratio benefit that you saw in the all-comer patient population. We necessarily did not see a similar degree of benefit in those that were ESR1 wild type. Now, while we see this benefit, is there a group of patients where we might see this benefit even better? Can monotherapy yield better than what we were able to achieve? And this was one of the ways of looking at that. I think this was looking at a clinical feature that we all look at in clinic for our patients in general. If they stay on a therapy for a longer period of time in the first-line metastatic setting, you would think that those patients have endocrine-sensitive disease. And on top of that, if they develop an ESR1 mutation, again, a surrogate of ER dependency of the tumor, that's where we saw the highest benefit with monotherapy elacestrant, specifically highlighted here. When you look at patients who've had stayed on their first-line CDK4/6 inhibitor for at least more than 12 months, or a CDK4/6 inhibitor when they got it in the metastatic for at least 12 months or longer, and had developed an ESR1 mutation, the median PFS here is in the order of approximately 9 months with elacestrant, compared to 2 months in the physician choice therapy arm. So that's how we think about how to best utilize these drugs as monotherapy for our patients in clinic, specifically these patients who are staying really longer duration of time or expected duration of time with their CDK4/6 inhibitor and develop an ESR1 mutation. That's where a monotherapy approval makes the most sense. A question always comes up, what about other alterations? If we think about PI3K alterations, if a tumor has both ESR1 and PI3K, so this was a subgroup analysis from Emerald that was performed. Again, this is a subgroup of a subgroup. So these are tumors that have ESR1 mutations. They also had PIK3CA alterations, as shown on your top left Kaplan-Meier curve. And these were specifically for patients who had a durable benefit and stayed on their CDK4/6 inhibitor for 12 months or more. And here, with both these alterations present, the median PFS is 5.45 months with elacestrant alone, compared to 1.9 in the physician choice therapy arm. On your top right are ESR1 mutations and PIK3CA wild-type tumors. Here, the median PFS with elacestrant is 9 months, compared to 1.87 seen in physician choice therapy. The bottom ones are looking at benefit with HER2-low or HER2-IHC0 expression. And here again, you see that regardless of HER2-0 or HER2-low, there is benefit with elacestrant compared to physician choice therapy. Now, this is an endocrine-based therapy. We didn't expect this to be any different, but I think this is something that we're now looking at carefully, given that we have approval for antibody-drug conjugates in such subtypes. And so this is why this analysis was performed. What about safety? I think it's a very well-tolerated drug. In clinic, what we predominantly see is some fatigue and some nausea. I have to highlight the nausea is also low-grade. We don't see a lot of high-grade nausea. In fact, when we think about how many patients required antiemetics on the phase 3 Emerald trial, it was approximately about 8% of these patients. Dose reductions or dose discontinuations from elacestrant due to nausea particularly were very, very low at 1.3%. One other unique thing that one has to bear in mind is monitoring the lipid profile. You can see hypercholesterolemia and hypertriglyceridemia with elacestrant as well, and as such, the package insert tells us to monitor lipid profile at baseline before starting elacestrant therapy and then periodically thereafter. There are certainly dose reductions that one can do. So you can start the patient at 345 milligram once daily, and there are up to two dose reductions that one can use. In practice, I have not had to dose reduce patients with elacestrant for toxicity reasons. It is well tolerated, but if you do have somebody who either had a high cholesterol or intolerable fatigue for whatever reason, or was very sensitive, had GI side effects like nausea that were requiring modification, certainly that is something we can do for patients. What other SERDs are available? So we have elacestrant approved. It's in ESR1 mutant tumors. We want to give it for patients who would stay on their CDK4/6 for a long time. It's well tolerated. Another drug that we saw data for was camizestrant based on the SERENA-2 study. Now, again, this is a phase 2 trial. These are very different patient population. Specifically, here, they were looking at different doses of camizestrant. I'll focus on the dose that is currently now in phase 3 trials, both in early and late stage, which is 75 milligrams orally daily, which is the bright blue color on this figure of the study design here. So this phase 2 study did not allow prior fulvestrant, did not allow prior chemotherapy. So this was predominantly a second-line phase 2 trial. Multiple dose cohorts, we're focusing on the 75 milligrams. About 51% had received prior CDK4/6 inhibitor on this phase 2, half of which had palbociclib, half of which had ribociclib. Very few patients had abemaciclib as their prior therapy. And as I said, only one line of endocrine therapy predominantly in the metastatic setting, so about two-thirds had one line in the metastatic setting. There could have been patients who progressed on their adjuvant therapy, and a third of these patients did receive camizestrant on SERENA-2 as their first-line therapy. And here are the results from the SERENA-2. On your left is PFS by investigator assessment. On your right is PFS by blinded independent central review. This is in the intent to treat patient population, where you saw with the 75 milligrams, that's your first column here in the sky blue color, 7.2 months. And with fulvestrant, it was 3.7 months. And when you look at with blinded independent central review, these are similar results. The hazard ratio is approximately 0.58. Similar to what we've seen with other data sets, here also PFS is by, in the ESR1 mutant cohort, here you see that the PFS nearly tripled from 2.2 months in the fulvestrant alone arm shown in red to 6.3 months at the 75 milligram dose with camizestrant. For the ESR1 not detected, which is on the right side, the PFS values are identical at 7.2 months for fulvestrant and for camizestrant. With respect to safety, again, on your right are shown the common toxicities. Now, unlike what we've seen with some other molecules, with camizestrant, we see some low-grade bradycardia and some low-grade photopsia. Although at the 75 milligram dose cohort, it seemed like the photopsia rates at low-grade and the bradycardia rates were lower than the 150 and the 300 milligram dosing. The dose discontinuation rates remain low. The dose reduction rates remain low. So overall, these are well-tolerated medications with low-grade toxicities, slightly distinct in terms of what kind of safety or toxicities that you see with each agent. This table just gives you a full flavor of monotherapy activity across various studies. The first two are the positive data sets that we've seen, Emerald, that led to the approval of elacestrant, SERENA-2 we just spoke about. We have two negative trials, amcenestrant, which was from AMEERA-3, which is not being developed any further, and giredestrant, which is currently in phase 3 trials from the Accelera trial. Again, these are very distinct patient populations. These have different phases and sample sizes. These were not all enriching for ESR1 mutations or had ESR1 mutation as their primary endpoint. Both AMEERA and Accelera were negative phase 2 trials. However, what was common across these studies was that the signal was still better in the ESR1 mutant tumors. So at least with monotherapy, time and again, whether it's comparison only with fulvestrant or with endocrine therapy, you are seeing that signal, which is better in ESR1 mutations for these monotherapy drugs to work. even though we're seeing all of this and we are excited about having these drugs available as monotherapy, I think one can appreciate from these Kaplan-Meier curves that 40% across the board still will have early progression on monotherapy, and 60% still will progress within 6 months of this benefit. And this kind of highlights an, you know, underscoring issue and unmet need that perhaps we still need combination therapies with these drugs as well to still derive better benefit. So yes, monotherapy works. Yes, we want to try and find the right patient for where the monotherapy might work the best, ESR1 mutation being one, but there is still an unmet need to go better than what we can achieve with these drugs, and combinations might be helpful. In that context, let me present the data from the EMBER-3 as well. So EMBER-3 was a trial that enrolled patients who have recurred on or within 12 months of their adjuvant aromatase inhibitor with or without a CDK4/6. Similarly, they could have had progression on their first-line therapy with an aromatase inhibitor with or without a CDK4/6, randomized to one of the three arms: imlunestrant alone, another oral SERD at 400 milligrams daily, versus standard of care endocrine therapy. And at early in the study, there was an amendment done to add a third arm, which evaluated imlunestrant plus abemaciclib. So there were three primary endpoints in this trial, looking at investigator-assessed progression-free survival, initially comparing imlunestrant alone with standard of care endocrine therapy, and that was looking at in ESR1 mutant tumors and in all patients. If either of these endpoint comparisons of monotherapy, whether in ESR1 or all patients, was positive, then they would ungate and do the comparison for the doublet of imlunestrant abemaciclib with imlunestrant. Other endpoints are listed here on the slide. With respect to patient characteristics, approximately 38% had ESR1 mutations at baseline. Approximately 38% had PIK3CA mutations at baseline. These were all detected with a Guardant ctDNA assay predominantly in the U.S. And another ctDNA assay for the China patients. A third of these patients had had progression on their adjuvant endocrine therapy and two-thirds on their metastatic therapy. Approximately 60% had progressed on CDK4/6 inhibitor prior to study enrollment, majority being palbociclib, two-thirds, one-third being ribociclib. And here are the Kaplan-Meier curves for the monotherapy comparisons. On your left is looking at imlunestrant versus physician choice endocrine therapy. Sorry, this went a little ahead. There you go. Imlunestrant versus standard of care endocrine therapy with ESR1 mutations on your left, and with overall all patients on your right. So here you see that there was a statistically significant improvement in PFS from 3.8 months to 5.5 months with a hazard ratio of 0.62. In patients whose tumors were harboring ESR1 mutations, this was statistically significant. So a 38% reduction. In contrast, on the right, when you look at all patients, there was not a statistical benefit that was seen. The median PFS is 5.6 in the imlunestrant arm compared to 5.5. And important to note that majority of these patients without ESR1 mutations showed no difference in PFS, and the hazard ratio there was 1. So really, again, you're seeing the same signal that you've seen across with ESR1 mutant tumors. So because that was positive, they then went ahead and did the comparison for the doublet with the monotherapy. And here again, you see that the doublet performed better than monotherapy. Median PFS is 9.4 compared to 5.5. Hazard ratio is 0.57, which is statistically significant. When we looked at, is there a difference by ESR1 mutations for doublet versus monotherapy? Regardless of ESR1 mutations, the benefit was maintained. The median PFS was 11 months for the doublet compared to 5.5 months with imlunestrant alone in those patients who had tumors with ESR1 mutations. In patients without ESR1 mutations, it was 9.1 months versus 5.5. So there was benefit seen with a doublet regardless of ESR1, which is different than what we've seen with monotherapy. Important subgroup analyses looking at benefit by prior CDK4/6 inhibitor and also by PI3K pathway mutation status is shown here. 65% of the patients who were enrolled to the doublet arm had progressed on a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. And here again, you see consistent with the overall population, you're still seeing the benefit for the doublet. 9.1 month PFS compared to 3.7, hazard ratio is 0.5. There was benefit seen even in patients with PIK3CA pathway alterations. So this is 7.6 months versus 3.8. Now let's turn to safety. I think the safety profile was also reassuring. There were low-grade toxicities of fatigue, diarrhea, and nausea. However, there were no more than 10% increase compared to standard of care endocrine therapy. And more importantly, there were single instances. So it's not like the patient continued to have the same toxicity for a long period of time. When we looked at grade 3 or higher toxicity, it was 17% in the imlunestrant arm, 21% in the standard of care endocrine therapy arm. Dose reductions were low at 2%, dose discontinuations low at 4%. And this was an interesting thing. While patient reported adverse events related to injection with fulvestrant in 9%, when we looked at patient-reported surveys with CTCAE, pro-CTCAE surveys, 72% reported injection site swelling, discomfort, and redness. So this kind of tells you from a patient perspective as well for an injection versus an oral drug, which was nice to look at in this data set. Now, on your right are the toxicity from the doublet. And as expected, with the addition of Abema, there was more diarrhea. But thankfully, again, this was predominantly grade 1 or 2. There were no new safety signals. In fact, this was in line with what has been reported in prior data sets like MONARCH 2 with fulvestrant and abemaciclib, with no new signals with Abema and imlunestrant. And the discontinuation rates remain low at 6% for imlunestrant plus Abema. So, similar to what Kevin had shown us about multiple combination trials that are currently ongoing, these are also ongoing in various distinct subtypes. And not only are we looking at combinations with CDK4/6 inhibitors or PI3K/AKT pathway inhibitors, but we're also looking at for triple-positive breast cancers, ER-positive and HER2-positive breast cancers. The Hidradenitinib trial is looking at that. Imlunestrant program in the phase 1 also is looking at that. And we're awaiting data sets from phase 3 for Evera and Pionera for giredestrant with everolimus and CDK4/6 respectively. We're trying to also study if CDK4/6 inhibitors plus a oral SERD might derive benefit if we use them in the first line. So instead of using AI CDK, if upfront we were to use oral SERD, can we delay these ESR1 mutations and can we further improve the bar? Can we further push the outcomes beyond what we've been able to achieve with AI CDK? We have two trials trying to address that question. And as Dr. Kalinsky mentioned, the SERENA-6 was a recent press release that we heard, which is looking at emerging ESR1 mutations on first-line therapy without radiological progression, where we made the switch to an oral SERD and CDK, and that's where we saw an improvement in PFS. So we eagerly await the details of this data set at ASCO. So key messaging, really, we have approval for elacestrant. This is for ESR1 mutant post-CDK4/6 inhibitor. We have a companion diagnostic, Guardant 360, so that we can determine this ESR1 mutations appropriately. You see a longer durable benefit in those tumors that have been on CDK4/6 for 12 months or longer. It's possible that imlunestrant monotherapy might get FDA approved. It's possible with in the future we might see an approval for the combination as well. SERENA-6 data might lead approval to camizestrant. We don't know. We'll see the data and hopefully see how that takes a path with respect to regulatory approval for our patients here. And I think we might see a future where these drugs will become a partner of choice with other targeted options, may it be CDK4/6 inhibitors, may it be PI3K pathway targeted agents, or other novel therapies that are being studied in clinic. We still need to understand the mechanisms of resistance of these drugs, however. I'll hand that back to you, Rita.
All right. So thank you so much for that very thorough review. Can we reset the timer, please? So this section is really just some questions, and I'm really going to engage with our panel to try to, you know, tease out how the field is evolving. So I've got some questions for you. And then we'll ask our expert panel to kind of to weigh in. So we have a 48-year-old premenopausal woman who presents with de novo metastatic hormone receptor positive HER2 low disease involving the liver and the bones, What additional testing would you offer her beyond hormone receptor and HER2 status? Genetic germline testing, next generation sequencing and germline genetic testing, a liquid biopsy and germline genetic testing, or all three, next gen sequencing, liquid biopsy, and germline genetic testing? So it looks like about 70% do germline testing, next-gen sequencing, and a liquid biopsy, and then about a quarter next-gen sequencing and germline testing at this time. What does our expert panel do? What do you typically do, Dr. Kalinske, in your practice?
I totally agree with that answer.
Okay. Yeah. So all three?
All three.
Okay.
Same.
Yeah.
Same.
All right. Okay, moving on to the next. So she has germline genetic testing that's negative. She has next-gen sequencing that is negative for alterations in the AKT pathway, negative for ESR1 mutations, not surprisingly. She begins treatment with ovarian suppression, an aromatase inhibitor, and a CDK4/6 inhibitor, as well as zoledronic acid because of the bone metastases. So how would you monitor this patient on treatment? Do you do CT scans and bone scans every 3 months, PET scans every 3 months, and then bone scans, CT scans, and a liquid biopsy every 3 months, or a PET scan and a liquid biopsy every 3 months? Wow. And it looks like about 40% imaging only, and then, about 50%, 55%, and then the rest, whether it's PET or CT bone scan, in addition, get a liquid biopsy. How about our panel?
I usually go ahead with PET scans every 3 months, to 4 months.
Okay, but no liquid biopsy?
Not for monitoring.
Okay.
Same. I mean, I think the one thing that could potentially change that is the study that we were talking about, SERENA-6.
Right.
But we will need to see those data and then the follow-up of those data and what, not just PFS. I think people will also want to look at PFS too as well. But I would say that this is something that I otherwise, like based upon PADA-1, I don't follow that paradigm.
Yeah. Ditto. And the only thing I would say differently is sometimes you get pushback on frequency PET scans. So we sometimes use CT bone scan.
Yeah. I would say my tradition is CT bone scan. And I do not generally incorporate a liquid biopsy unless somebody's progressed. So she responds well. Unfortunately, after a year and a half, experiences progression in her bones, in her liver as well, but still not a lot of bulky disease. So what would you do at this point? Would you biopsy her liver metastases and repeat receptors and next-gen sequencing? Would you do a liquid biopsy and next-gen sequencing on a tumor that you've biopsied? Or would you just treat with fulvestrant and with or without a CDK4/6 inhibitor or everolimus? All right. So about half would repeat a biopsy and do a liquid biopsy. About 1 in 6 would just go ahead and treat with fulvestrant and perhaps a targeted therapy. And then only 6% would do a liquid biopsy. So what would our panel do?
Be more inclined to get a liquid biopsy. She had a liver biopsy, if I'm remembering correctly.
Correct.
Not that you can't do it again.
Right.
But, you know, you might get all the information you need from a liquid biopsy with less morbidity.
I'd be comfortable with the liquid biopsy alone. Yep.
Yeah. Same. I mean, I think if this was a patient who was rapidly recurring, right, like let's say she was on endocrine therapy for just a couple of months, that may be a circumstance where I would think about doing a liver biopsy and retesting. But otherwise, she's on for 18 months, I think I would just do a liquid biopsy.
Yeah. I think me as well. So it's kind of interesting. Only 6% of you would do just a liquid biopsy. I would say, you know, the times where I will consider a repeat biopsy is if the cancer is behaving in an odd way, like Dr. Kalinske was saying, you know, picking up the pace, or if, you know, one component of the disease is progressing and everything else looks, you know, like it's responding. So sometimes I'll repeat a actual tumor biopsy, but I think outside of a trial, I would probably just do a liquid biopsy here. And I think we've seen and we'll continue to see some data in that space. One other question. So she has a liquid biopsy, found to have an ESR1 mutation. What treatment would you offer the patient? Elacestrant monotherapy, fulvestrant monotherapy, fulvestrant plus everolimus, fulvestrant plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Remember, she does not have an AKT pathway alteration. Right, so about 80% elacestrant monotherapy. What does our panel think outside of a trial? Because I know we've all got trials, but outside of a trial, what would everyone do?
I would agree.
Yeah. All right, I would as well. With that, Dr. Gradishar, I'll pass it to you.
All right, so my task is to, having heard about the past, the present, mine is to discuss the near future. And I could be very exhaustive, but I'm not going to be because there's a lot of compounds that are in development that we won't talk about, although, you know, it's tempting to go through them all, but we won't do that. So I'll also try to keep it at a high level because you're going to see some redundancy in the slides, and I'll probably cut to the chase on several of these. So you've heard about ARV-471 already. Think of it as a baton with a molecule at each end. One end, you know, captures the estrogen receptor. The other, E3 ligase, making it an attractive candidate for ubiquination and then proteasomal degradation. And it's been demonstrated in preclinical models that you really drive down the estrogen receptor expression. There have been trials, as you would expect, starting in a phase one space and then moving on to looking at some combinations with ARV-471. And this is sort of the VERITAC development program. And again, efforts to identify the best tolerated dose and what would have an objective response. In the dose escalation trials that were done, it was demonstrated that you could see a clinical benefit rate even in patients who had gotten prior therapy of up to 40%. And when they did translational work to determine the effect of the drug on estrogen receptor expression, it was decreased by almost 90%. So proof of principle that what was happening in preclinical models could be demonstrated as well in patients. So the phase two VERITAC trial, again, was looking at different doses of ARV-471, 200 milligrams, 500 milligrams. And these were in patients who had gotten prior endocrine therapy, who had gotten it for at least 6 months, had gotten a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, and could have gotten up to one chemotherapy agent. And again, the primary endpoint was looking not only at adverse events, but the clinical benefit rate as the primary endpoint. The demographics of the patients that were involved in the trial are outlined on this slide. And as you can see, it was a composition of patients that had both wild type and mutant ESR. And if you look towards the bottom on the right-hand side of this slide, you can see that these patients had been exposed to a variety of other endocrine agents, and a significant chunk of them had gotten CDK4/6 inhibitors, and most of the treatment had been in an advanced disease setting. What this experience demonstrated is that generally the doses were well tolerated, whether at 200 or 500 milligrams. There were about three dozen patients in each group. There was very high toxicity. There were a couple of patients that did die on the trial. There was discontinuation in very few, and the most characteristic abnormalities that were identified in only a few patients were elevations of liver function tests, some neutropenia, and fatigue. So again, if you look across the experience in more granular fashion, which is outlined on this slide, you can see that those adverse events occurring in more than 10% of patients receiving either the 200 or 500 milligram dose as monotherapy. The things that were most dominant were fatigue, usually grade 1-2. You're not seeing much either at 200 or 500 milligrams at high grade 3-4 in this experience that was reported. There was some nausea, there were some ALT elevations, but again, very few patients having high grade abnormalities. And if you look at the primary endpoint of the study, which was the clinical benefit rate in patients who had gotten prior therapy before going on this trial, and look at the number of patients that did have ESR mutations within the group, you're seeing a clinical benefit rate hovering around 50%. So proof of principle that the drug is active, it works in patients that were previously treated, patients who had ESR mutations, and seemingly relatively well tolerated. And again, this is another way of looking at it on a waterfall plot. The hatch lines reflect those that had ESR mutations, the others that were wild type. And below the straight line going across are obviously tumor regression. And you're seeing that a significant fraction of the patients with ESR mutations had significant tumor regression. But it occurred in both patients with wild type as well as ESR mutations. Progression-free survival, what you can do with that in a relatively small population is hard to say, but it's roughly around 3 to 5 months if you look at the right or left side. All patients are on the right, those with an ESR mutation somewhat longer, around 5 to 6 months. So again, small numbers, but a suggestion that it's not only active from an anti-tumor standpoint, but it translates into reasonable time to disease progression. And proof of principle, what was seen in animal models was recapitulated in patients. If you look at the degradation of the estrogen receptor based on the mechanism of action in the patients that had tumor tissue available to be analyzed, you can see that the vast majority of them had a significant decrease in ER expression, down by about 70%. So this is, you know, the theme of all of these drugs is nobody wants to be a monotherapy. So the drug development with every one of the things that you're hearing about and that I'll subsequently talk about is what can you combine with and what are the toxicities. So ARV-471 has been combined with palbociclib in a hormone receptor positive metastatic patient population, a phase 1b experience, which is shown on this slide. Again, drawing your attention to the far right, lower right, most of these patients have gotten significant prior endocrine therapy, targeted therapy before. And what was demonstrated yet again is that with this drug in combination with palbociclib, you are seeing tumor responses. And I believe there's a slide that would suggest that you're also seeing the predictable side effects that go along with adding a CD46 inhibitor, which is on this slide. And as you can see where the arrow is drawn at the top, what are you picking up? Neutropenia. What would you expect with palbociclib? Neutropenia. Additionally, there were a few patients that had QT prolongation. So a small experience. It's a phase 1 trial, but demonstrates that you can combine. The phase 3 VERITAC trial 2 is shown here, and this was a comparison between ARV-471 and fulvestrant at 500 milligrams. And again, these were patients who couldn't have gotten prior fulvestrant, they couldn't have gotten prior chemotherapy, but their most recent endocrine therapy had to be for at least 6 months and with one line of a CD46 inhibitor, and the primary endpoint was PFS. And the VERITAC 3 trial, and I should also give you a spoiler alert, you're going to hear a lot about the things we talked about at ASCO this year. So you'll actually, rather than hearing about schema, you'll actually see some data. So the VERITAC 3 trial, again, ARV-471 plus palbo, the initial part of the trial, which is in the middle, is looking at two different doses. And once the appropriate dose was identified, it went on to a combination of ARV-471 with palbo compared to letrozole plus palbo. And we'll hear more about that, obviously, at subsequent meetings when the data comes out. Now, complete estrogen receptor antagonists, or CERANs, their mechanism of action is that they basically, when the estrogen receptor duplex comes into the nucleus and attaches to DNA, it attracts other proteins, so activating factor 1 and 2 as well as other factors. And when you have a serine attaching to the estrogen receptor, you're basically shutting down the activation of activation factor 1 and 2, whereas with tamoxifen, you have a partial effect. This completely shuts it down. So guess what? There are a variety of phase 1 trials that are underway with monotherapy as well as in combination with CD46 inhibitors. Basically, I think the takeaway from this slide is that there are dose-finding efforts to determine what is best suited for combination with palbociclib. We have some minimal data that is available at this time looking at that trial. And again, you can see that there are about 80-some patients that have been treated, of which about half have ESR mutations. And what we can say is that when you look at this combination is that you are seeing, number one, activity. Progression-free survival is in the 4 to 5 month range. And again, there haven't been any prohibitive side effects that have been identified to date. The most common one, again, hearkening back to what you would expect with the CD46 inhibitor, being neutropenia, which was seen in 6 patients. So there were no big surprises, but it's a phase 1 trial. There is a phase 3 trial referred to as the OPERA-01 trial, which again is looking at 2 different doses of palazestrant versus standard of care endocrine therapy, the preference being fulvestrant. And once the optimal dose of palazestrant is identified, that would be randomized to those patients receiving standard of care endocrine therapy. And what we do know from the phase 2 data, not the phase 3 schema that I showed you on the prior slide, is that there is activity with this drug, as you can see in sort of a swimmer's plot. Patients on different durations of therapy, different exposure to prior endocrine therapy on the far left, but you can see the vast majority of patients are indeed responding. And of those patients, the clinical benefit rate is on the range of about 40%, and about 40% of patients had prior fulvestrant. ESR mutations were present in about 50% of patients. So it's sort of a mixture of different kinds of patients with different exposures, suggesting that the drug does work, and we'll see what it does in a more formal setting in a phase 3 trial as well as with the CD46 inhibitor. The SERCAs, which Kevin alluded to, are selective estrogen receptor antagonists. In a very simplistic way, what these drugs do is when they attach to the estrogen receptor, they change the conformation of it, and as such, it has an antagonist conformation, and it also appears to have a particular efficacy in combination in preclinical models with palbociclib. There are, of course, phase 1 trials that are ongoing, and we don't have a lot of data from them, but as you might expect, they're dose finding, toxicity identifying, and the ultimate goal is to take these into populations that have ESR mutations and then ultimately in combination with other drugs. So what data we do have would suggest there's activity. So you can scan this slide. Most of the responses in a patient population previously treated are not complete responses, but you are seeing response rates in the 30 to 50% range, clinical benefit rate about the same as well. So the drug is active, and we'll have more data as that comes along. Progression-free survival and overall survival, for what it's worth in a phase 1 trial, there's activity, translates into some progression-free survival. And again, we're seeing activity in patients who have ESR mutations. So going old school, lasofoxacine, so a SERM. This is a drug that's been around for 30 years. It sat on a shelf for probably 2 decades of those 30 years. It was a drug that was being developed for bone health and vulvovaginal atrophy, and then sort of people lost interest in it as other drugs came along. But it was also identified as a drug that potentially would have activity against tumors that have ESR mutations. And, if you look at some of the old data in preclinical and mouse models, it clearly identified that there was activity in patients with ESR mutations, which led to suddenly a renewed interest in this drug, leading to a number of different experiences that have been reported, ELAINE 1, 2, and 3. And again, this is the ELAINE 1 trial, which was a comparison of lasofoxacine to fulvestrant in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative disease with ESR mutations who had already progressed on an AI and a CD46 inhibitor. Again, it's a small experience, but as you can see from the slide, the PFS was longer with lasofoxacine than what you see with fulvestrant. And this provided the impetus to go on, particularly since these were being observed and this activity was being seen in patients with ESR mutant tumors. So the ELAINE 2 program looked at the combination of lasofoxacine with abemaciclib. These were patients who had progressed on a prior AI plus palbociclib. And from the swimmer's plot on the far left, you can see that a significant fraction of these patients responded and had extended duration of time on therapy, and this ultimately is leading to a variety of other trials underway. Now, the next series of slides, I am not going to make you squint. I'm going to tell you what they say in about three sentences. So there are a bunch of experiences that are ongoing, and as I preface my comments by saying that everybody wants to be a doublet, nobody wants to be monotherapy. So whether you're talking about elacestrant, whether you're talking about any of the drugs that are coming along that I'm discussing, they are being explored in combination with every targeted therapy that exists that we currently have for breast cancer. So you have the Electra and Elevate trials, which were alluded to earlier, and we have a number of different experiences that are looking at this. Suffice it to say, when you combine these drugs with targeted therapy, you get activity, and the predictable outcome is you're seeing the toxicity associated with the targeted therapy. So there's not some expanded toxicity profile that becomes apparent when you combine these drugs. Guess what? When you put them with a targeted therapy, you get a little bit more activity than you might expect with monotherapy. So the take-home message is that, you know, there are a lot of these strategies being employed. We have minimal data at this point, usually on the order of, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 patients in a cohort that has a particular endocrine agent combined with, be it alpelisib, capivasertib, whatever the drug is, you're seeing activity and predictable side effects. And again, this is the elacestrant Elevate trial. We've talked about it. I'm not going to say anything more. These are data that were recently presented at ESMO, showing that in a handful of patients, if you combine elacestrant with other drugs, you're getting activity. Okay. And the take-home message is more will come. All right, I'm done.
Thanks so much, Dr. Gradishar. We have a nice amount of time for some questions. There are some great ones that have come in through the app, but if there's anyone in the room who has questions, please head to the microphones, and I'm just going to start asking away while we wait for some people to head to the microphones. I think, you know, a question that's, you know, a little bit more straightforward, but I think is, you know, one that maybe someone can address is if you could explain what the difference between next generation sequencing and liquid biopsies are, and why would you do both at the time of initial diagnosis? Someone want to take that?
Kevin. I am happy to. I am happy to. So next generation sequencing is really just, you know, umbrella terminology for looking at different alterations, including mutations, right? And so I think the way that we were kind of utilizing that phrasing was, you know, looking at mutations either in tumor tissue and blood, right, with circulating tumor DNA. And the, so sometimes one checks with circulating tumor DNA and there may not be any detection of any circulating cells. And in that sort of circumstance, it might be worth then looking in metastatic tissue, like not so much, or even the primary tissue, but like we'd said, it's not going to show for ESR1 mutations. That would be looking for instance, PIK3CA mutations, which are seen early. And then the only other thing that I may say, and I'm curious if my colleagues would like to chime into this also, is just, you know, there are some data that, for instance, like we have some data that Manali Bhave, one of my colleagues, had published, was that P10 alterations may not be seen in the same rate, meaning they're at a lower rate in circulating tumor DNA than what we may see in tumor tissue. Mm-hmm. And so that is the discrimination, and I don't know if you guys have anything you would like to say.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it's thinking about next generation sequencing applies to both tissue and plasma. That's the information you're looking for with these samples, whether it's tissue or plasma. Some mutations, such as ESR1 alterations, are acquired alterations, right? They're happening under the selective pressure of an aromatase inhibitor. They're happening in the metastatic setting. Now, subclonal means they're being acquired. So if you were to just go after a biopsy in the liver, for example,
You don't know what's happening in the bone. If you did not see that in the liver, does not mean that it's not happening elsewhere in the body. So these alterations from these various sites will spill into the blood, and you'll be able to pick it up in the plasma. So for ESR1, you really want to go after the plasma, which is why you might recall the tables we were showing. The prevalence is up to 40% in the second or third line setting. If you were to look the same prevalence in a tissue, it's approximately 20%. So you'll capture them better in the plasma. So it makes sense to do it that way. PIK3CA alterations, on the other hand, are truncal alterations or clonal alterations. What does that mean? Truncal means they could be present in the primary tissue. They could be present in the metastatic tissue, whether you did it at diagnosis. They could be present later in the diagnosis. And that's how they're captured from any tissue you can get. You can get them in the plasma, and that would be okay. Occasionally, if you miss that in the plasma due to low tumor burden, there's not enough to spill in the blood, and that's why the plasma is negative, the gold standard would be to go back to tissue. So if you've not had an opportunity to test the tissue at all, and you've only had plasma that was negative, at least once you should try the tissue to get the plasma. The question was, why would we want to do both at the time of diagnosis? I think turnaround time is also something which is attractive to get, right? Now we have data such as INAVA 120 in the first-line metastatic setting for patients who are progressing on or within 12 months of adjuvant endocrine therapy. If we find the PIK3CA alteration, you can give them the triplet. And I think plasma assays such as Guardant can report out, say, within 8 days. And tissue can take 2 to 3 weeks. And sometimes you don't want to wait that long. So that's when you would try and do both. One, because the tissue could be cooking and you might be able to capture and get that data anyway, but maybe the plasma information you might be able to utilize right away. So that's how I think about them.
Anything to add?
I don't have anything to add.
All right. Another question for Dr. Gradishar. So you have a patient who is on a CDK4/6 inhibitor and an aromatase inhibitor, and they progress. And they have both AKT pathway alteration as well as an ESR1 mutation. What would you treat that patient with?
So everybody can have a bias. There's no right answer. So, you know, you could either go forward with a, elacestrant as monotherapy. You could consider capi plus fulvestrant. There isn't direct comparisons of which one is the best. Some people would say, well, I think I should give a doublet because, you know, there's more disease or it's aggressive. Do we know that that's true? I would submit we don't know that. So personally, I don't know that there is a clear answer based on what would be the most effective. I think you also have to pull into the equation the characteristics of the patient and what she's going to tolerate, et cetera, in terms of side effect profile, because that could play a role in your decision-making as well.
Dr. Kalinske, anything to add?
Yeah, no, the only thing, just to build upon what Dr. Gravishar had mentioned, is just the idea that, you know, I would consider, I think, elacestrant as a reasonable option, in particular, as Dr. Zaveri had mentioned, for those patients who are on their prior CDK4/6 inhibitor for at least a year, just demonstrating endocrine sensitivity. And the only other thing that I would add is, this is where the world is right now in March 2025. I do think that things are really moving forward. We have these new novel endocrine therapies. We have new PI3K inhibitors and AKT inhibitors that are in development. And so, as Dr. Gradishar mentioned, we're increasingly wanting to move beyond utilizing single-agent endocrine therapy. And so I think that this will be a ever-evolving field in the near future.
I have a question specifically for you, so that's why. But I think for me, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with how long they were on their prior therapy, how bulky their disease is, how aggressive their disease is behaving. Because some of the patients who have AKT pathway alterations, their disease just is really aggressive. And you do want to consider, you know, kind of doublet therapy or targeting that pathway, because we think that, you know, it's really an aggressive case. So, you know, bulk of disease, how rapidly they progressed, you know, usually factors in for me.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I may just add is just you know, post-CDK4/6 inhibition, when we utilize something like fulvestrant capivasertib, that median PFS is about 5.5 months. And I think some of the things, and while we should not be doing cross-trial comparisons, we'll do it anyways, you know, in EMBER-3, when we saw the combo of imlunestrant and abemaciclib, we really moved beyond, for those patients with prior CDK4/6 inhibition, it's about 9 months, right? So I'm really just bringing that because that's where we are now, but things will move.
Yeah, and that leads into a great question I have for Dr. Javeri. One of our questions from, more are coming in, but I'd changed from primarily using palbo in the first-line metastatic setting to now primarily using abema or ribo. But given the EMBER-3 data, are you inclined to use less abema, ribo in the front-line setting so that you can use it in the second-line setting?
It's a fantastic question. So I think, you know, we were all kind of palbo users in many ways until we started seeing the overall survival data with ribociclib, and we were like, okay, why not ribo? Because we have such overall survival results that we've been able to see, despite no head-to-head comparison for palbo-ribo necessarily. My practice has been ribociclib as standard of care since then, since I switched with the overall survival data sets coming out. I do think even before EMBER-3, I was using ribociclib first, and then upon progression, if I had to consider, I would think about using abemaciclib at the back end. And I think, you know, with post-Monarch, Dr. Kalinske had presented the results, and they're now published as well. We had seen that patients predominantly had seen palbociclib, and a third of these patients also had ribociclib. And the benefit was seen in post-Monarch for both. However, when we looked at the confidence intervals, you know, for the ribociclib cohort kind of went. But again, these patients, one could say, okay, maybe we are seeing benefit only with palbo. We're not necessarily seeing after ribo. That could be one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it would be that this study was not necessarily powered for choice of CDK4/6 inhibitor. They were not stratified by that. That was not how we were trying to power them and look at that. And EMBER-3, same thing. Two-thirds were palbo, one-third were ribo. We did see the benefit, and it did not cross one. So I think it was just a matter of numbers, I think. I personally don't think that that should make a difference. My practice right now is ribo. I'd be very comfortable utilizing abema at the back end.
Great. A question from one of our surgical oncology colleagues. From a surgical standpoint, do oncologists test biomarkers before patients get metastatic disease, meaning at the time of initial diagnosis? I'm not sure what specific biomarker. I'm assuming sequencing and liquid biopsy, perhaps.
Well, I would say some out there do. I don't. But I guess, you know, we'll see if we evolve that way. But right now, I don't think the information's actionable. So, you know, we're still fundamentally making our decisions in early stage disease based on ERPR HER2. And we don't really employ any of the targeted therapies yet in an earlier stage of disease. So I don't typically do that.
Same. There's a really nice question here about ESR1 mutations emerging in the adjuvant setting. And, you know, should we be looking for it earlier? And if we find it, should we be doing anything here? I am aware of trials that are ongoing looking for that, but I don't know if any of our panel members have any comments on what they're doing in the context of their practices.
I'm not doing anything in my practice at the moment, to be honest. You know, when we looked at data sets until now, primary tumors, the ESR1 mutation rate is low. It's about 1%, so it's really low and much rare. It usually is what we see in the metastatic setting. Having said that, there have been some emerging data sets where we've seen with longer duration of endocrine therapy, which is what we're doing now, we are seeing some rising numbers. So if you recall MONALEESA-2, for instance, at baseline, so that's a frontline metastatic study, at baseline in cell-free DNA, it was 4%. And those numbers have become higher, inching to 10 to 15% in some data sets. And so, yes, it's possible that we might see a slightly higher rate of ESR1 mutation. And there are ongoing studies with oral SERDs right now in the adjuvant setting. I think the idea there is not necessarily targeting ESR1 mutations the way we've seen in the metastatic setting. The idea there is, can we use a better endocrine agent or an optimal endocrine agent, overcome issues with non-adherence, overcome issues with toxicity, but perhaps they might have that extra edge in this emerging ESR1 mutation cases as well, where maybe we might be able to derive that benefit even in the adjuvant, you know, patients who are getting long-term endocrine therapy. But I'm not doing anything particularly to look for them right now in my clinic.
another question. We have a few more minutes, so if any questions in the audience, please head over to the microphones. Is there any evidence using CAPI in hormone receptor negative metastatic breast cancer in patients with an AKT pathway alteration?
I can address that. So, you know, there was some real initial enthusiasm about AKT inhibitors, not just capivasertib, but ipatasertib as well, in phase 2 trials, but the phase 3 trials did not show benefit.
Yeah, and those were with chemotherapy. And so I think that whole line of research is really not panning out. So one question specifically about a patient. So I have a patient who has an ATM1 mutation. I'm assuming you mean germline. Also has an ESR1 mutation. She's progressed on 1.5 years of elacestrant. She's currently stable on T-DXd. Can I target ATM? There was in TBCRC 48, which was a trial called Olaparib Expanded. Nadine Tung run that trial, looking at patients who had DNA repair damage genes that were involved. So it looked at patients who had germline mutations in some of these other genes beyond BRCA1 and 2, ATM included, and PALB2. And then it also looked at somatic BRCA1 and 2. And in that trial, what was found was that those patients who had germline PALB2 mutations and somatic BRCA mutations, BRCA1 or 2, seemed to have a benefit from, you know, a proportion. I think it was like 75% of germline PALB2 mutations and about 40% of patients with somatic BRCA1 and 2 had responses to therapy that were somewhat durable. There were a handful of patients who had other genes, including ATM1 or ATM, and there really didn't seem to be efficacy there. I think, you know, it was a small number of patients, so I think it's really hard to know. It may be possible to get a PARP inhibitor. You could try. But again, I think the modest amount of data we have would suggest that it hasn't been as effective as we would have liked it to be. But that's the only data set I'm familiar with.
And that's the same experience in early phase trials with, say, ATR inhibitors or, you know, agents targeting the DDR pathway. Monotherapy has not necessarily been very exciting, and combination has been hard to tolerate. So overall, my experience has been targeting ATM1 mutations with currently available phase 1 drugs or PARP inhibitors has not been very promising, unfortunately.
So with that, I would really like to thank our expert panel for their wonderful presentations.